From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, August 1st, 2017. And on this day, the details on Secretary of State Matt Dunlap's second refusal to give information to the Trump administration's Voter Fraud Commission. And the New Yorker writer who wrote the famous story on Anthony Scaramucci. That's ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
First tonight, Maine's Attorney General is one of 15 in 15 states, along with the District of Columbia, that's suing the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and its administrator, Scott Pruitt. The lawsuit alleges that Pruitt has illegally delayed designations of areas with high ozone levels. Under updated rules to the Clean Air Act, the EPA approved in 2015, the agency's required to designate those areas by October of this year in order to trigger state-specific plans to reduce pollution. But Pruitt says the agency will delay those designations for a year. Maine Attorney General Janet Mills says there's no time to waste.
We have 316 to 660 premature deaths every year from these kinds of lung diseases that are affected by ozone.
She says the state's geographical location means it bears the brunt of lax clean air standards to the west. According to the American Lung Association, more than 24,000 kids and 120,000 adults have asthma in Maine. Secretary of State Matt Dunlap says he is refusing a second request by the Trump administration's Election Fraud Commission to turn over Maine voters' personal information. Dunlap is one of four Democrats serving on the commission, which opponents have assailed as a sham designed to nationalize Republican voter suppression efforts. Steve Missler has more.
Dunlap has said he's keeping an open mind about the fraud commission. But in a letter sent to its chairman, Kansas City Secretary of State Chris Kobach, Dunlap asked for clarity around how Maine's voter information will be used.
We need to know what our goals are. There are some real questions here about whether or not this data can be secured, and it may not provide us with anything of any value anyway.
The commission initially requested the voter data, including names, addresses, party affiliations, and voting histories, with the plan of making it public. But that request was rejected by 44 state election officials, including Dunlap. Last week, the commission sent a second request, saying that it planned to keep the information private. Dunlap says the new request leaves questions about whether the commission can unilaterally decide what it can shield from the public and, ultimately, its intentions. Dunlap's response reflects skepticism about Trump's commission, which the president created after repeatedly asserting without evidence that there was widespread voter fraud in last year's election. Kobach and Vice President Mike Pence said during the commission's first meeting in mid-July that the panel had no preconceived notions or preordained results about voter fraud or policies to restrict access to the polls. But when President Trump himself addressed the panel, he suggested that states who refused to turn over voter information were hiding evidence of widespread fraud.
If any state does not want to share this information, one has to wonder what they're worried about. And I asked the vice president, I asked the commission, what are they worried about? There's something. There always is.
Dunlap says neither he nor the state have anything to hide, but want to ensure that Mainer's private information is secure.
This is not about me versus my own commission, or me versus the president, or me versus Secretary Kobach. It's really about following the law.
Dunlap says he's also frustrated that the commission did not discuss the new request for voter data during its first meeting, and that some panel members appear to be requesting more data, but not explaining why. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Maine is expected to be about 50 school bus drivers short this year. This in mind, the state departments of education and labor are reaching out to veterans to let them know there is free training available to people who are interested in becoming bus drivers. Maine Department of Labor spokeswoman Julie Rabinowitz says being a school bus driver can be a very good job.
The pay range for school bus drivers in Maine can range between $11 and $25 per hour, and they can also have part-time schedules and earn benefits depending on the district for which they are working.
And Rabinowitz says some districts even offer hiring bonuses. People who are interested can sign up through their career center or contact the Maine Department of Education. And while the initiative is specifically geared towards veterans, the free training is available to anyone who's interested in becoming a school bus driver.
Hail to the bus driver! bus driver, hail to the bus driver, man.
Ryan Lizza has been covering politics for The New Yorker for 10 years. Recently, he broke the story about Anthony Scaramucci's profanity-laced rant that played a part in ending his tenure as White House Communications Director shortly after it began. Lizza is in Maine this week to give a talk at the College of the Atlantic. He spoke with Keith Shortall about his interview with Scaramucci, a well-known source to reporters covering the White House and the Trump campaign. Lizza says Scaramucci's feud with the recently ousted White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, went beyond mere politics.
He would tell anyone that would listen that he had this job lined up at the White House and that Reince Priebus, who he had a very vulgar nickname for, was blocking it. And remember, you know, in his defense, he had good reason to be angry that this job was blocked. He sold his company, which is worth, you know, I don't know, several million dollars. And if you go into government service and you have to divest of certain assets, the government will give you a waiver so that you don't have to pay the capital gains taxes on the sale, right? So he was in a situation where he gets a White House job. He goes to the Office of Government Ethics. They say, if you want to work in the White House, you got to sell this, this, and this. He sells it, and then the job gets blocked, and he's left sort of, you know, with this enormous tax bill. So, I mean, you know, part of the reason he was so desperate to actually have the White House fulfill its promise of a job is because he had sort of done everything you're supposed to do before your government service. He had three different meetings with the president set up to talk about a job, and he believed that all three of them were canceled by Reince Priebus. Now, finally, he got in there and had that private meeting with the president the morning he was hired.
So finally he gets in. Priebus is no longer blocking him. But then why does he call you and risk everything with this on-the-record vulgar rant once he's gone to all this effort to get into the White House?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is, one, he knew that Priebus did not want him to be the communications director. And he suspected, though with no evidence, that Priebus was leaking negative information about him. So on the day that he called me, the morning had started with an article in Politico that raised some questions about Anthony Scaramucci's finances. The information came from his financial disclosure form, which public officials are all forced to fill out. He believed, and I don't know why he believed this, and he didn't really have any evidence, but he believed, and he told me, that Reince Priebus leaked that information illegally, in his words. He said, he told me it was a felony, to Politico. And so he was already worked up that day about this article, thinking that Priebus had leaked it. And so the second thing that got him all worked up was something that I tweeted. I tweeted that he, Anthony Scaramucci, was having dinner with the president and Sean Hannity and a few other people. He got out of that dinner and he saw his phone. He had messages from other reporters asking for details of the dinner. And he said, wait a second, how does anyone know about my dinner? And so he called me, and the whole conversation started with him trying to find out how I knew about his dinner. I mean, he was frankly a little bit paranoid. And I told him, sorry, Anthony, I can't tell you that. You know, the people who told me that told it to me under ground rules that do not allow me to tell their names. And so that's how the conversation started, with him appealing, doing this very strange appeal to my patriotism, saying, you know, be a patriot, tell me who your sources are. And then he did this strange thing where he threatened to fire everyone on staff if I didn't tell him, his logic being that then I haven't protected anyone because everyone's going to be fired. Really unusual thing to say. And then the conversation interview just sort of went off from there, where we started talking about, you know, Priebus and Steve Bannon. But it all started with his, I think this is the only fair way to describe it, his paranoia that the chief of staff was trying to undermine him, and that the Politico story and the story of the dinner were parts of this. Now, he was completely wrong. The Politico story had nothing to do with Reince Priebus. My trivial knowledge of who the president was dining with had nothing to do with Reince Priebus, but he got it in his head that those things were being leaked to undermine him.
And he had said after this that, or suggested that he didn't think that you would print this, and that he had trusted a reporter, and he would no longer do that. But you have challenged that pretty firmly, and even indicated that you had a conversation with him prior to printing it, saying, look, this was on the record, and he understood that and kind of regretted what he had said.
It was not only was it on the record, but it was a recorded interview on the record. And I, before we published it, I did want to talk to him one more time, and just to sort of go over a few things to make sure he knew it was coming and to make sure that we had the same understanding about the conversation. And indeed, we both agreed that it was well within my rights to publish what he told me, because it was both on the record and newsworthy. Now, he didn't like that, but there was no indication that, you know, there was any journalistic rules being broken to publish it. He called me. You know, he called me and started talking. He's the communications director at the White House. He speaks for the White House.
Do you think he was just venting with you and misplayed it?
I don't know. I don't know. Some people have suggested he did it on purpose because he wanted this stuff out. I'm not sure I believe it. I'm not sure.
That was the second part of my question.
Some people think that. Other people just think he was bad at his job. He told the reporter for Vanity Fair this week that he simply lost his temper.
Have you reached out to him since? Have you tried to talk to him?
I have. I wrote a piece yesterday, and after he was fired, and I texted him. To see, you know, obviously like everyone else, I wanted to talk to him after he was fired, get a response from him, but I didn't receive any reply.
And that's Keith Shortall talking with New Yorker politics writer Ryan Lizza. He's in Maine this week to give a lecture at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor as part of the 2017 Champlain Institute. He will share audio from the Scaramucci interview on this week's New Yorker Radio Hour, Saturday at 2 o'clock. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine, Tuesday, August 1st, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.